Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all ready to ride?
Everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Injust Us, the show that shares stories of injustice and allows listeners to ask questions and seek advice. Each week, we feature guests who are making a difference in the Black community and or changing the criminal justice system. My name is Melinda Robertson, and I am your host and member of the WPGR All-Female Radio Network. I am the founder of Black Mothers for Justice, Inc., a 501c3 nonprofit organization created to be a support system for single mothers whose sons or daughters are incarcerated. On Sunday, August 30th, 2020, I will be hosting a virtual launch party via Zoom for the release of A Black Mother's Guide, How to Survive the Criminal Justice System. This book was written out of necessity because statistics show that one in every three Black boys will go to prison in their lifetime, and 72% of Black children are raised by single mothers. It is a much-needed resource that provides valuable information about arraignment, posting bail, bondsmen, public defenders, etc. So please save the date. Tonight's guest is Renee McDonald Hutchins, the Dean of UDC Law School. She is a leading expert on the Fourth Amendment and criminal appellate practice. She has authored three textbooks: Learning Criminal Procedure, Developing Professional Skills, Criminal Procedure, and Essential Lawyering Skills. She also writes on the law of racial profiling and stop and frisk. Dean Hutchins is a graduate of Spelman College and Yale Law School. I had the pleasure of meeting Dean Hutchins several years ago while she was working on my son's appeal. One of the things she said to me was that she was going to fight for my son as if she were fighting for her own, and that is exactly what she did. I thank God for her commitment to fighting for the wrongfully convicted and successfully having my son's conviction overturned. Please help me welcome to the show Dean Renee Hutchins. Hello, Renee. How are you?
I am fine. How are you?
I am great. Thank you. It is such an honor to have you on the show tonight. I am so thankful that you agreed to be a guest on the show. I am so honored. Thank you.
Happy to be here. You ask, and I said yes.
Well, I appreciate it. So let's get into it. At what age did you know you wanted to become a lawyer, and why?
So I don't know that I can actually peg wanting to be a lawyer to any one point in time. What I can say is that my dad used to tell a story when I was growing up, and I think that the story spoke to me about the power of the justice system, and so it was something that grew in me gradually and almost imperceptibly. So my father's family is from South Carolina, and his family was very involved in one of the companion cases to Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court case that overturned segregation in America's public schools. My dad's family was involved in the Clarendon County case. So Brown was actually five cases. The Clarendon County, South Carolina case was one of the five. And as a result of his family's involvement in that, my great-grandfather, my father's grandfather, got a lot of unwanted attention from the Klan in South Carolina. And my dad used to tell a story about how his grandfather, my great-grandfather, one day the Klan had planned a rally, and they were going to ride past the front of my great-grandfather's house. And my dad was about 10 years old at the time, and he used to tell about how he wanted to go in a house, he wanted to hide, he was scared. That was at a time when the Klan was just with impunity lynching and killing Black people for being, quote, out of place. And my great-grandfather insisted that, no, they were going to sit on the front porch and they were going to face down the Klan. And I remember in my father telling that story when I was growing up, I remember always thinking, what was it that made my great-grandfather confident enough to do that? He was a Pullman porter. He wasn't a particularly powerful man. He wasn't a particularly prestigious man, a wealthy man. What gave him the power to want to do that? And I realized that it was his belief that the court system and the justice system would make the world better for his grandson, my father, in a way that allowed him to be brave. And so I think from a very young age, I came to believe that the law could be a power for good and could transform the world in really important ways.
Wow. What a story. Wow. The great-grandfather. So we're talking about like maybe in the 20s, 30s? Wow.
So my dad was about 10. It would have been in the 40s, so in the late 40s. So the Brown decision came down in 54, and the precursor cases were kind of working that were being built in like the late 40s.
Wow. Well, he would be very proud. I'm sure he's looking down and very proud of his great-granddaughter. Yes, and all that you have accomplished. Yes, 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 yes. So where does your passion, so that's what that has to do with your passion for the wrongfully convicted as well, huh?
It does. So I feel strongly that that we each owe a debt, and I have this conversation with my kids all the time, that we each owe a debt to leave the world better than it was when we got here. And I think that that can look a lot of different ways to a lot of different people. So, you know, you may decide to clean up the world by being an artist. You may decide to make the world a better place by being a teacher. I chose to try to make the world a little bit better by engaging in the criminal justice system and fighting for people who otherwise didn't have a voice. And I think that the way that we treat those who are least among us, those who have been accused of horrific offenses, those who society is ready to discard, the way that we treat them says more about us than it does about them. I have never believed that we should be judged by our worst 15 minutes, that we all have, you know, that chapter that we don't read out loud. And some of us were fortunate enough that chapter never gets read out loud. And some of us, our chapter is read out loud very, very publicly in ways that implicate us in the criminal justice system. So for me, fighting for those people, giving them a voice, you know, my clients and the people that I represent in the criminal justice system, giving them an opportunity to be heard and to be treated with dignity, because so much of the criminal justice process is about stripping people of their humanity and stripping people of their inherent dignity, that if we could restore that if we could each work hard to ensure that system was working better, more correctly, that I could do my part in terms of making, you know, leaving the planet better than I found it. And you know, hopefully I'm making a little bit of a difference. Hopefully I'm cleaning up my corner, as my former dad used to say.
Well, you definitely are, I must say. So your resume is quite impressive. So how were you able to accomplish so much while being a wife and a mother?
Because, girl, I'm worn out. You know the deal. I am worn out. So, I mean, I don't think I'm unique in that regard, to be really, really honest. I think black women have been putting in the work as wives and mothers and employed outside of the home for generations, right? Like, that's not new. We have been working on all fronts, on all cylinders, for a very, very, very long time. And I also recognize that in many ways I am incredibly fortunate. I have the support of an incredibly supportive spouse. I have resources. I have a family who can, you know, help me raise up these children right. I have an incredible friend network. And so it would be dishonest of me to suggest that I did this by myself. I didn't. It truly takes a village and has taken a village for me to accomplish many of the things that I've accomplished. But more important than that, I have always felt that I owed it, right? Like, the generations that preceded me poured into me and my brothers. And so I owe it to the generations that follow me to pour into them, be that with my children or with, you know, the young people that I teach and that I work with as the dean of UDC Law School, or as young people who I am representing as my clients, that I owe it to them because of everything that has been given to me. That is my debt that I have to pay off.
Wow, that's amazing. So, as a mother of two young black men in America, what is your greatest fear when it comes to the criminal justice system?
That's a hard one. That they would be implicated in it. You know, I think you said at the outset when you were doing the introduction, you said, and I remember having this conversation with you when I first picked up Harry's case. I remember saying to you that I would represent him like I would represent one of my own. And I meant that, because my greatest fear as a parent is being in a position where I cannot protect my children. And mm-hmm. that is, I think, for too many black parents, exactly what the criminal justice mm-hmm. system is. It is this opaque box that sucks their children in, and they have no capacity to protect their children once they are inside that box. And so for me, my greatest fear as a parent would be that my children would become implicated in the criminal justice system, because it is brutal and inhumane in the way it deals with black and brown young men and women in this country. That every time my children leave the house, right, that is one of the things that I always say to them: come back to me safe, right? Don't get arrested.
Mm-hmm.
I think the stakes are so much higher now, right? Because unfortunately, one of the things that this modern movement is exposing, right? It's not new; it's been happening for a long time. Is that for many of us, the greatest fear is not just our children getting arrested; it's our children not coming home. Because they have been killed at the hands of lawless officers.
Yes, that was definitely my greatest fear. But thank God that there are people like you, that there are people like you out here that really have some compassion and empathy for mothers like me that have been put in that situation and our children entangled into that wicked system. Thank God for you. I wish I could clone you. I wish I could just clone you, because you are just so authentic. Yes. We need more committed people like you that feel that they have a debt to be paid. I thank God for you. So in all your years as a lawyer, what was the biggest miscarriage of justice you've witnessed?
You know, that's a really hard question for me to answer, because I have seen so many. You know, I don't know that I could boil it down to one. I think that miscarriages in the form of people being pushed to plead to something because the risk of going to trial was so extremely high, no rational person would not plead. That to me is a miscarriage. Sentences handed down that were just so far outside the realm of anything rational. That just you look at the sentence and you say, what criminal justice goal is this supposed to advance? And you just are grasping to figure out what the goal is. Representing people on appeal and having appellate courts say that they are going to ignore an error because trial counsel didn't speak precisely the right words to preserve the error, that it almost feels sometimes like it's turning into a gotcha game. But it's a gotcha game with real human consequences. Those are just some of the miscarriages. And then the system itself and the ways in which the system just strips people of their dignity and their humanity in the most unnecessary ways is to me a miscarriage, right? That there is a way. I am certainly not a person who believes that there is no role for a criminal justice system in society, that I am not, you know, an abolitionist by any stretch of the imagination in that sense. I think that people can violate societal norms and should pay for I believe that there is a role for a just criminal justice system, but the criminal, particularly because the victims too often are people that look like me and you, Melinda, but there is an inhumanity to our current construction of the criminal justice system, and there is a, you know, they say that the punishment is the process, and that is real. The inhumanity and injustice that is being handed out in our current criminal justice system, I find an absolute abdication of so many constitutional norms and just an absolute miscarriage.
Yes, it really is. I believe the question, do you believe that COVID-19 is going to change the face of the criminal justice system? And if so, in what way?
I don't know. My concern is that it might do it in very, very, very unhelpful and dehumanizing ways. The pandemic. Now, I think that the civil unrest and the social justice movement that we're seeing is going to change it in positive ways. My concern with regard to the pandemic is that we are learning to do things much, much, much more quickly and easily with technology, right? And that's not always a bad thing, but I think that it can be a bad thing when it facilitates a more efficient processing of human life. And so my concern with regard to the pandemic is that we may see increasingly a move to video conferencing and video hearings in an already inhumane, grossly administrative processing of justice already. So that would be my concern with regard to the pandemic. With regard to the social justice movement, though, I actually do think that we are finally starting to see what I think some people had feared was just going to be a moment turn into a movement. And we are finally starting to see a broader array of voices speaking up and saying the way that we are doing things is no longer sustainable. And I think that the extreme reaction on the right and the extreme reaction from conservatives is in many ways sort of a death spasm and a recognition that the old system is dying and has to go. And so my hope is that we will see real progress. I don't mean superficial progress. I don't mean courts saying Black Lives Matter and then behaving in ways that suggest they don't, right? Or politicians mm-hmm. making statements or renaming bridges or statues, but then not actually doing any substantive work to get at the underlying injustice. My hope is that we are actually going to see real substantive change with regard to the way that we criminalize and penalize behavior in this country.
Yes, I agree. Can an inmate appeal his case before being sentenced? If so, how much time do they have to file the appeal? And if not, when can they appeal their case?
So you can file a motion for new trial prior to being sentenced in Maryland. If I am remembering correctly, the timeline is 30 days. I have not filed a motion for new trial in years because I now do almost exclusively appellate work. I believe it's 30 days to file a motion for new trial. And so you could do that before you were sentenced. That's not technically a, quote, appeal. The appeal actually happens, so that is the move into that intermediate appellate court, the Court of Special Appeals in Maryland. That move happens after your sentence, and it happens by filing what is called a notice of appeal. It's just a form. It's a really basic form. It's like a two-sentence form. And you file that with the trial judge, and all that you're telling the trial judge is, I am going to be taking this case up to the intermediate appellate court. And what that form does is it triggers for the trial judge a recognition that the record needs to be preserved in a particular way, and the record then needs to be forwarded to the Court of Special Appeals so that the appeal process can then happen in front of the Court of Special Appeals.
Okay. So how does the Court of Appeals determine an inmate's eligibility?
So with regard to that first line of appeal, so there are – so in Maryland, there are three levels of courts. The most basic level of courts is the trial courts, and that includes both the circuit court and the district court. All felonies are tried in the circuit court. When you leave the circuit court, so if you are convicted in the circuit court, your next step in terms of reviewing your case would be into the Court of Special Appeals, which is the intermediate appellate court. And that is not a can I or can't I, right? That is you file a notice of appeal, and as a matter of right, if you were convicted of a felony in Maryland, you will move into the Court of Special Appeals. The Court of Appeals is actually the highest court in Maryland, and that can be confusing for a lot of folks because we're accustomed to hearing the Supreme Court is the highest court, but actually in Maryland, the Court of Appeals is the highest court. And so the Court of Appeals is the highest court. You do not go into the Court of Appeals as a matter of right. So you actually do have to be, quote, eligible to go into the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals gets to make that on its own. So they are a discretionary court, and they decide whether they are going to hear cases, and they will decide to hear a case. I'm really focusing on criminal appeals right now. They will decide to hear a criminal appeal if they think that the case is sort of a matter of discretion, like the law needs to be clarified, or if they are interested in making new law in an area, or if they feel like the case presents a question that is sort of statewide importance, right? That it's not just a narrow issue that is just relevant to that particular defendant and that particular state's attorney's office, but it's a broader question that actually could impact a lot of different cases. So that's how you would move into the Court of Appeals. Everybody does not get to go into the Court of Appeals to have their case heard. So most cases stop, and most criminal cases stop in the Court of Special Appeals in terms of review. And only a teeny tiny fraction of cases actually get up into the Court of Appeals for additional review.
Okay. Thank you so much for clarifying that. I've definitely learned a lot through going through that process with Harry. So how is it that
more than you want?
How is it that
I'm sure?
Oh my gosh! Yes, I feel like I could go to law school as involved as I was.
Right.
So how is it that the Court of Appeals can overturn a conviction and the circuit court not acknowledge the ruling?
So that's not technically possible. but what can happen is the following. So sometimes when a case comes down from the Court of Appeals, there are only a handful of reversals of criminal convictions that actually don't allow the prosecution to retry the accused. And so I'm trying to figure out how to make this really quick. So if you go into the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals decides that the process in your case was flawed, right? They're not speaking actually to the evidence itself. They're not speaking to the substantive question of guilt or not guilt, right? They are just speaking to the process was wrong. Something should have happened that didn't happen, or something didn't happen that should have happened. In that instance, when the case is sent back down, your conviction is reversed. You are no longer a convicted person for purposes of the criminal justice system. But that does not mean that the state cannot retry you. And so even after your conviction gets overturned, your case will return to the circuit court, and the prosecution would then have about 180 days to decide if it is going to retry you. And that delay, that lag, that sort of you still sitting waiting for the process to work itself out does not mean that the circuit court is ignoring what the Court of Appeals said. It just means that the circuit court is allowing the prosecutor to decide what he or she is going to do with your case in the time that they have to make that decision.
Okay. So if they decide to retry the person, okay, whose conviction was overturned, if they decide that they want to retry the person, so they can just start all over from the beginning, how often does that happen, would you say?
More often than not. So if the only time that the prosecutor absolutely categorically cannot retry you is if the appellate court says either the evidence was insufficient in the first instance, right? They don't get two bites at the apple. If they presented the best evidence they had at your first trial, the jury or the trial judge convicted you on that evidence, it goes up on appeal, the appellate court looks at it, and the appellate court says, actually, that evidence was not sufficient as a constitutional matter. That evidence was not sufficient to get you to guilty. If that is the ruling of the appellate court, the prosecution can't retry it. You're going home. Your conviction is getting overturned, and you're going home, unless there's some other charges that they have that they can bring against you. Whatever charges the evidence was insufficient on, that's done. That case is completely done.
Okay.
If the court
decides, how often does that happen? I'm sorry.
That is a very rare finding. So insufficient evidence is not one of the more common. I'm not saying it's uncommon, but it is not one of the more common appellate findings. Typically, what you're getting in the appellate court is a reversal because of bad process. And when that's the finding, the prosecution can always retry you. And I'm not saying they always do, but they almost always can. The only other time that the prosecution is probably not going to retry you is if you win on a suppression motion, right? So if you're down in the trial below, the police, your allegation is the police illegally seized some evidence from you, and that evidence is the only evidence the prosecution has in the case. Let's say the trial judge says, no, I think that evidence can come in. We're going to let the prosecution try you. You get convicted. You go up on appeal, and you ask the appellate court, hey, can you take a look at that suppression ruling? Shouldn't this evidence have been kept out? The appellate court says, yeah, actually, you're right. The evidence should not have come in, should have been suppressed, was absolutely seized illegally. If that is the only evidence the government has against you, when the case goes back down, you can't be retried, right? So if it was a drug possession charge and the drugs get suppressed, you don't have a drug suppression. You don't have a drug possession case anymore, right? So you're not going to get retried on that. But sort of the run of the mill is some other process question. Should this question have been asked of this witness? should this instruction have been given? Should the witness have been allowed to answer this question this way, right? That's the more technical stuff that you see on appeal. And if that is the basis for the reversal, no, the witness should not have been allowed to answer that question. Yes, the witness should have been allowed. All you do is you go back down and you get a, quote, redo, right? And so you go back down, and whatever the evidentiary ruling is, they don't get to ask again. I think it depends in terms of the question of whether the prosecution is actually going to retry you on the charges. That is entirely discretionary on the prosecutor's part. And so they will make assessments about the value of the case, how much time you've served, how strong the case was against you, what your criminal record looks like. Those are the kind of factors that will go into the prosecution making an assessment about whether to retry the case. Melinda, I think I might have lost you.
Renee?
Uh-huh.
Renee? Okay, sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm here.
So, okay, great. Okay, so if you could please explain to the listeners what it means for prosecutors and judges to have complete and total immunity.
So it means not good things. So absolute immunity will shield a prosecutor from, or a judge, from suit, civil suit, after they have conducted a trial, if the reviewing court thinks that the prosecutor or judge was acting entirely within sort of the four corners of their authority as a prosecutor or judge. So just to put some facts on that scaffolding, right? So let's say hypothetically, you were charged with drug possession. You know the prosecutor, you grew up in the same area with the prosecutor. You know that the prosecutor can't stand you, has always had it out for you, and it is your and you don't like the prosecutor, right? Like, you've got this back and forth thing going with the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
You get convicted of the crime, your conviction is later overturned on appeal, and you then want to bring a civil suit against the prosecutor alleging that it was not the fact, but it was personal animus that actually caused that suit to happen, absolute immunity would prevent you from bringing that civil suit.
Okay. So in your opinion, does their immunity, that their prosecutors and judges having immunity, does that impact mass incarceration in any way?
I think that the bigger drivers of mass incarceration are prosecutorial discretion in terms of charging decisions and sort of prosecutorial abuses in terms of overcharging cases, and the absolute explosion that we have seen in terms of criminal offenses on the books, right? And so there are so many different ways that you can violate the law. And frequently what we will see is we will see a horrific case happen. And then we will see a slew of laws passed in response to that horrific case happening, like some horrific crime happening against a person. And a whole bunch of laws.
Okay.
And what is overlooked in that rush to create all of these new crimes is that frequently there are already crimes on the books. There are already laws on the books that criminalize whatever the particular behavior was, right? And so then some people will say, well, what's the big deal, right? Like, if there are already crimes on the books, what's the big deal if we're just duplicating them? The big deal is that when another crime is then committed, it gives the prosecutor incredible leverage. Because now, instead of charging one offense that might bring with it, right, a 5-year mandatory or a 5-year minimum, the charges that the prosecutor can bring now may include, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 offenses. And those 5 or 6 or 7 offenses will each bring with them their own sentencing structure. And that mm-hmm. is what creates enormous pressure on people to plead. Because if I am looking at a 5-year sentence and I believe that I have a very strong case and, you know, I've got a decent lawyer, I've got decent witnesses, right? I've really got a decent case. It's a roll of the dice because you never know what the jury is going to do. But I feel I've got a pretty solid case and I'm looking at 5 years. I'm willing to take the chance to kind of vindicate myself and to have my voice heard. If, on the other hand, I am looking at 85 years, right? Because the mm-hmm. prosecutor has been able to identify 7 or 8 or 9 different charges that I could be charged with, and each one of them carries mm-hmm. a 5 or 10 year minimum, that calculus suddenly is looking a lot less rational, right? And so I may be willing to plead to one of the 10 charges that I have been charged with, even if I feel like if I was just being charged with the one, I'd go to trial on it. If I'm looking at the 10, the risk is just too high. And so in terms mm-hmm. of mass incarceration, I think it's the explosion of criminal offenses in the books. I think it is the discretion, the really arbitrary power of prosecutors to charge books worth of criminal justice offenses in basic cases, and it is the over-policing and under-policing of communities of color, and it is the criminalization of drug offenses, right? It's sort of that perfect storm of of events that I think has led to mass incarceration. James Forman actually wrote a really good book, and I'm blanking on the name of it right now, but he was talking about the ways in which Black politicians in the 60s and 70s were asking for additional tools to address, failing schools in their system, in their communities, and crime in their communities, and crumbling infrastructure in their communities. And the only thing that the federal government came back to them with was enhanced criminal punishment. And that is when we started to see that extreme ramp up in terms of mass incarceration.
Wow. Wow. Did you ever envision yourself as a dean and definitely not only as a dean, but the dean of an HBCU?
So I didn't. I was a teacher at the University of Maryland for a lot of years and was extremely happy there. And loved my students and loved my colleagues. I thought it was a terrific school. And then the deanship at UDC Law, the University of the District of Columbia's David A. Clark School of Law, where I am now, opened up. And I started to take a look at the school. And the more I learned about it, the more I fell in love with it. I was talking earlier about responsibility and duty. There are six HBCU law schools in this country, and I feel like it is our absolute duty and obligation to keep every single one of them strong and vibrant and educating students, students who are interested in social justice, students who are committed to fighting for what is right in this system, that so much of the unfairness in the criminal justice system is about an imbalance of power and about the two sides in that adversarial process not being equally resourced. And so it is so important to me to educate really talented, committed lawyers who are willing to fight the good fight on both sides of the V, right? Who are willing to do, we need fair, justice-minded prosecutors. We need fair, justice-minded defense attorneys. We need fair, committed lawyers who are going to be willing to put in the work to ensure that the system works better. So I am so happy to be doing the work I am doing at UDC Law, so happy to be doing it. Because it is mission work in the most profound and important way. The students there are incredibly committed and bright and inspiring. And, you know, I say all the time, they are my North Star, because they are so committed to fighting the good fight and learning all of the tools of the trade so they can go out and be social justice warriors and do exactly the kind of thing that I am talking about has just been kind of a driving passion in my life forever.
Oh, that is awesome. So in addition to your role as dean, do you actually still practice law? Are you still practicing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I will never give up the practice of law, ever, ever, ever. So I.
Oh, really?
So,
okay, how does that work?
I love the practice of law. I've actually got a case that I'm taking into the Court of Appeals in September. I personally do not understand how you can teach somebody to love something that you don't love, right? And so...
If I did not
love the practice of law, how in the world would I be able to teach students to have that passion and that fire and that commitment, right? Being a lawyer is really hard work. And if you don't love it, you're not going to do a great job at it. And so one of the best, like the things that I love most about being in legal academia is being able to take a case and show students how to work that case right and be committed to that case and work hard for that case because there's a real person standing on the other side of all that paper. So, yes, I will never give up practicing law, ever.
Wow. Well, that's good to know. Your students are very fortunate to have you. They have one of the best. So were you surprised that the death of George Floyd turned into the worldwide movement we are seeing today?
I actually was. I really, really was. You know, I was talking to I've got two sons, 15 and 18, and I was talking to them shortly after George Floyd had been murdered, and just as the social unrest was starting, and. I was really like profoundly depressed. Like I felt like we had been here so many times before, so many times before. You know, I still remember Rodney King and that video like it was yesterday. I remember Amadou Diallo. I remember, right? Like I remember so many of these instances of injustice against brown and black men and women, right? Mm-hmm. And women, say her name. So. And so I was just feeling like, here we go again. And my 18-year-old said, and I can't remember which, it must have been Minneapolis. I don't remember where it was that had just sort of gone up in flames. And he said, now maybe they'll hear us. And I realized that for each new generation, that expression of rage, right? They say that riots are the language of the unheard. And for each new generation, that expression of rage, that absolute expression of frustration and exhaustion and wanting to scream your humanity to the heavens so that it will be seen, was for them brand new. And so even if it felt incredibly old and we've been here before, to me it wasn't that for them. And so for their fresh eyes, right, in a moment where the pandemic had locked the country down and there was nothing else to pay attention to, for them this was almost like a rebirth. And so in that sense, it surprised me in the moment, but kind of when I look back on it and think about it, it's like, no, it actually makes perfect sense. Right, it makes perfect sense that this is the moment that we're in. You know, and what's going on the national scene is just so insane. I just think that people have hit that wall, right? Like that breaking point where people are just like, enough, just enough.
Yes, it was just so heartbreaking for me as a mother when I heard him calling his mom. Oh my God, I was just in tears. It was just, you know, but here we are how many weeks later, months after his death, and the protests continue to go on. And I'm just so impressed and so amazed at our young people, because our young people have been on the front lines protesting his death for months now. And at the same time, gun violence has been escalating in the black community nationwide. How do you think we could take the same energy from the Black Lives Matter movement to stop the violence?
So I think it's a lot of stuff. I think that Reverend Al said it right the other day at one of the funerals. He said that we can't keep telling people that Black Lives Matter until we believe it, right? And I recognize that there are a lot of reasons that our young people are feeling frustration, that they are turning inward in the sense that they are turning it against their own brothers and sisters. And we have got to recognize the pain that they are struggling with. We have got to recognize the hopelessness that so many of them are dealing with. And we have got to heal those wounds. But it is incumbent upon us as now the elders of our community to not demonize our young people, but to reach out to our young people and help them find a better path. The other thing that I would say with regard to turning this moment into a movement is, if you have gone out and marched and said that Black Lives Matter and worn a T-shirt about I Can't Breathe or Black Lives Matter and you don't vote, then you are just virtue signaling. And all that you are doing is performative, and that you have got to follow up that in the street energy with something substantive. And so vote, write one of your elected representatives. You know, you've got to do something in addition to the marching, that you cannot leave that energy on the street. And so, you know, if you cannot vote for some reason, you're not a citizen, you've been disenfranchised. If you cannot vote for some reason, take somebody else to the polls. If you cannot vote, take a young person and mentor them. If you can vote, vote, and then make sure that you take a neighbor to vote, right? Until we ensure that our voices are heard, not just in the streets, but also at the ballot box, we're not going to change anything, right? We are going to spin our wheels with useless energy, protesting, marching, chanting, and the system will continue to operate in exactly the way that it always has. So I would really hope that all of this energy that we are seeing right now, people are also taking a minute while they are home tomorrow to ensure that they're registered, to ensure that they know where their polling place is, to ensure that they know if they are going to be voting by mail, how to get that ballot, and then to actually take the step to get the ballot so that they are able to vote, so that they have figured out a plan of action if they're not going to vote by mail for what they're going to do if they do have to sit online for hours to vote, right? Bring a lawn chair, bring a book, make it an event. Like, figure out what you're going to do to exercise that civic duty and obligation. Because if you don't, trust and believe the folk on the other side are well prepared,
will be out
and
there,
well organized,
yes,
and they are doing everything they can to ensure that people don't vote and that people's voices aren't heard. Let's make sure they don't win.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. So, speaking of the March on Washington that's coming up in a few weeks on the 28th, will you be out there on the front line?
You know I will. You know I will.
Absolutely. 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 But let
family.
Me ask you this. Let me ask you this. But, okay, so we're talking about the march, right? And we're in the midst of this pandemic. So, and Reverend Al is saying that we're going to be able to practice social distancing, but how can you practice social distancing in a march? And my concern is basically for the metros, you know what I'm saying? Like the metro system. I'm one of those people that's been in the house for the last 4 months, because just the thought of being around people. You know, I mean, I'm serious, because I'm a woman of a certain age, and I'm susceptible. So I don't want to, you know, I haven't had any functions at my house, or I have a huge backyard. I haven't done nothing the entire summer for fear of, you know, my family contracting COVID-19. So what do you say to people like me, and how can we get around that at a march?
So you can't, right? And so one of the things that I would say is that COVID is hitting Black and brown communities in disproportionate ways, in ways that it is not hitting white communities. And so we have to be very mindful of that, right? Injustice does not stop at the courthouse door. Injustice bleeds over into education, into healthcare, into economic opportunity, right? There are so many different ways that injustice impacts the lives of Black and brown people in this country, and we have to be mindful of that. And so to anyone who says, I don't feel comfortable marching because I don't want to get sick, because I'm vulnerable, because I'm worried about my own health or the health of my family, I say to them, stay home. But don't just sit at home, right? Figure out what you are going to do to ensure that the movement moves forward. So like I said, vote. Talk to your family about voting. Do all the stuff that you can do while operating safely during the pandemic. With regard to people who do go out, so I have been out at a bunch of marches since the pandemic started. I am extremely mindful of constantly keeping a mask on. I do not touch my face at all and do not touch other people while I am at the march. And immediately when I get to the car, I am hand sanitizing, I'm pulling the clothes off, putting new clean clothes on, right, taking a shower, making sure that I am being as safe as I possibly can in the confines of a civil, you know, movement that is happening in the streets. But I would say that I think it speaks profoundly to the injustice of the moment that people are willing to risk their lives, literally risk their lives in the middle of a pandemic to ensure that the world understands that Black Lives Matter. And so, you know, if you can't be out in the streets during the marches, that's okay. We are in the middle of a pandemic, but you got to do something.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm still sitting on the fence. I'm still sitting on the fence. I mean, my only dilemma is the metro. It's the metro thing, because if the metros are filled to its capacity, you're in that cart and you're amongst all these people, and then so many people will not wear their masks, are refusing to wear their masks. So that's just my stuff.
Yeah, but, I hear you on that.
So, before we wrap up, what's next for Dean Renee Hutchins? You have done so much. I can't imagine, but what's next? What's on the agenda?
I'm going to be at UDC Law for the near term. So we have a lot of good work that we need to do there. And I have every intention of being there to do it. It's a remarkable institution and it just has so much potential. And I want to make sure that I do everything I can in my time at the institution to ensure that it is the best version of itself it can be. And until I am confident that I am no longer of any use there, that's where I'm going to be, putting the work in.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much. UDC is very, very fortunate to have such a committed leader. You are such a phenomenal woman. I tip my hat off to you. I hope to see you at the march. Because I'm working on this, I have to let go of my fears. But I thank you for your service.
You have to do something else to get folk out to vote.
Yes, absolutely. I'm definitely doing that. But I just want to thank you for being on the show tonight. Thank you so much for all your work, for your service, your commitment. We need to have more like you. You have a great evening, and thank you so much.
You do the same. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
All right. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Dean Hutchins is a leader in the community who has changed the face of the criminal justice system. I applaud her commitment to fighting for the wrongfully convicted and empowering the next generation of students at UDC to be the change they want to see. If you have a story of injustice you would like to share or would like to recommend a topic for discussion on a future show, please DM me. I am author Melinda Robertson across all social media platforms. Next week's guest will be DC's own Queen India Blocker, a young sister who has been giving back to her community for years. She was featured on Fox 5 News last week and is making a difference in the lives of many. Thanks for tuning in tonight, and we will be back at it again next Tuesday from 8 to 9. Stay safe and be blessed. Peace.
Y'all ready to ride? Latest and the greatest of your lineage. Makeup and clothes, ain't you? That's what your image is. Here's what it really is. Perception is direction. You receive what you perceive. What you give is what you get in. This lesson is the weapon that I already gave you. Fear not. Draw your gun, your God, universe, nature. Game changer. Your higher self is calling you. The vehicle for change has arrived. What you want to do?
I want to take a ride. I want to feel the vibe. I feel the good inside.
Let's rock.
I want to take a ride. I want to feel the vibe. I feel the good inside.
Let's rock.
I want to take a ride. I want to feel the vibe. I feel the good inside.
Let's rock. Take a ride, take a ride, take a ride round the block now. Everyday scene, dope fiends and the cops round. At any traffic stop, we could be shot down. And in the courts, it's just us, justice is not found. Roadblocks, checkpoints, and the lockdown. If you ain't strong, it won't be long before you knock down. But there's another way, turn up what these others say. You the most important thing you have to think about today. So here's what I'ma say, listen while I'm rapping it. Your mind.
mind, that's a magnet. What you think, you'll attract it. So ask it to manifest the things that you really like, friends that you really like, not the hateful, silly type. Don't be deceived by greed, here's what it's really like. Their body drives a car, but their mind rides a mini bike. You know the person that you be and ain't all of you. The vehicle for change is a rob. What you wanna do?
I wanna see.